briefing this evening for Phil. And maybe I can just run down some of the stuff that he went through before I go into just some brief things as to like what we're doing as a movement. I wanted to stay like pretty loose. If people have stuff they want to chime in on and just speak up, like it's somewhat informal. There's not too many of us here, which we could change. I mean, we can build these things bigger in the future. But in the States, as an organization, we've somewhat done some renovating, as it seems. Part of this has been souping up certain locals, moving people around, etc. Just to really push with a lot of this fundraising stuff. I think it underscores the necessity of really building a recruitment base here in Canada where we have the ability of doing something like that. But there was one really interesting thing out of Seattle where Congressman Jim McDermott had a town meeting. Here's a guy that's been in the House of Representatives for like 20-something years. And he had this town meeting, right? Like all his constituents come out in Seattle. And as we got there, there was a petition going around to support Congressman Kucinich's H.R. 333, which is a preliminary bill of impeachment against Dick Cheney. So already we get there, and the environment is totally polarized around impeachment, which is usually our job. We go into a place and we try to polarize it around impeachment. In this case, it was somewhat done for us. Now, what happened was, is the guy touched on it every now and then in his speech, but, you know, dismissed it when it came to Q&A. We got the first question in. We asked him, Congressman, what is your stance on impeachment? He says, well, I'm wholeheartedly against it. It's going to jam up the works, and I'm going to stick by the party line, essentially saying I'm not going to go beyond the whims and wishes of Nancy Pelosi, and, you know, who just got back from Greenland, who noticed that, indeed, in spring, glaciers melt. Right? And now she's, like, running around saying, no, we're not going to impeach, we're not going to impeach, we're not going to impeach. The population's totally up in arms. As soon as we ask this question, what's your stance on impeachment? He says, well, I'm not going to push the issue. Everybody's fucking hand in the audience shoots up. And he's got this mob. He's got this guy, he's got this mob just confronting him. Impeach, right? Iran war being one of the reasons. The lies to get into an Iraq war in the first place, another of the reasons. Torture policy. The fact that this guy is actually promoting a torture policy, etc. The United States is up in arms about this. The constituents up in arms about this.
Which congressman?
This is McDermott from Seattle. But it underscores something also that's pretty interesting, because we have a youth movement in Seattle which is recruiting like crazy. They've just had another wave of recruitment. And they're organizing the people who are showing up at these meetings, putting pressure on the congressman. So the conception here, and the fact that McDermott reacted in this way, because eventually he freaked out, and he said, what can I do? He says, I'm not the dictator. What do you want me to do? What do you expect me to do? I'm not the dictator. Right? Of course, Roatan and the Democratic Party fundraisers are. In a sense, Nancy Pelosi and what she's mouthing reflects that. Right, the dictator in this case isn't Cheney, because Cheney's not saying, don't impeach me, you little twerps in the Democratic Party. No, it's coming from the Democratic Party itself. So what he's reflecting is a power structure which reflects fascism inside the Democratic Party. He says, I'm not the dictator, right? Kind of freaks out, has this, like, you know, kind of unstable moment where he's letting himself kind of reveal. He tried to switch the subject to global warming in the Q&A. People were talking about impeachment. He was like, people were like, no, fucking impeach this guy. But then we had the last question as well. And my friend developed this notion of classical tragedy. And he said, look, it's not the question here of what happens to you if you go out on a limb and impeach Dick Cheney. The question is, what happens to the nation if you do not act beyond yourself and beyond what's comfortable and beyond what's expected from you, and go along with something which is grand and unnerving? So I mean, what we're doing inside the states, I don't want to dwell on it too much because it is somewhat external from the political situation here. But in another sense, the mindset of the population, this notion of classical tragedy, is there. And you have a sense here that, well, we're just Canadian, right? Senators are losing. It's time to get depressed again. Fucking queen, hate the queen. But, you know, she's not really that important. I hate her, but she doesn't do anything. The sense that there really isn't in Canada a classical culture, a classical tradition. Like in Germany, right? We've got a massive youth movement in Germany. They have a latent and a dormant classical culture, totally marred by what happened in the 30s and 40s. But nonetheless, there's like a certain like attachment that people in Germany have towards a classical tradition, because there's a history of it there. In Canada, I think part of the mindset of the population is a lack of definition as to what their culture actually is. Right? Is it just that we're not American? Or is it that, you know, we may speak French? You know, therefore this ability to be bilingual is... Hello? Welcome? His ability to bilingual is somehow a national trait. I mean, in a sense, it is. A language culture is incredibly important to uphold. And you want to provide that for a reason that I'm going to get into later. But in and of itself, it's not a principle of mankind. It's not like you're saying, well, we're going to establish a republic on humanist principles because all men are created equal in the image of God. And we're not animals. Right? It's on a different level. So... What we've been doing all over the world is, in a sense, trying to push nations, which are in a similar predicament. I mean, all nations kind of have their specific cultural parameter. It's very interesting to try to organize within that. Trying to assess, well, where are the boundaries of this cultural mindset? Where is this culture going to break to the point where real revolutionary leadership shows itself? And, of course, with that, you have the potential of a Jacobin, irrational lynch mob, because you've got a society which has enough disorder in it to provoke that. However, understanding a certain cultural mindset, looking at a culture even if you're existing within it and from it, somewhat from the outside and above, and assessing, well, what is actually acting upon the population here. And I think Rob has been attempting to get at this with a lot of this historical work. If people read the leaflet that we're distributing today along with the other one, you see an impulse within this youth movement to communicate those kinds of ideas. We don't want to get at politics of a single issue as such, but rather really zoom out. I mean, you get a similar thing when you're looking at like the Iraq situation or the situation in Darfur or something like this, where people have a very quick, like, well, we're fighting terrorism. Right? Or you know, the Khartoum government is committing genocide on the people of Darfur. Get the terrorists. Stop the Muslim extremism. Stop Khartoum. What's acting on this situation? What culture are these people coming from? How are they thinking about their society? How are they thinking about you entering their culture? Right? What is their conception of the West? Most of these countries, right, they have a history of imperialism. They have a history of encountering the Western standard state way of living, stuff like this, lifestyle, Christianity, in a lot of sense, like their first, you know, real, the Christian missionaries may have been the first, you know, time the West really integrated into a lot of these other cultures. So to map it historically from that standpoint, when you're talking to somebody, you're basically talking to an individual who has free will and is obviously thinking for themselves, but is reflecting a cultural mindset which they're existing in. And similarly, it's looking within yourself and figuring out, well, what is truly human within myself and what is imposed upon me by cultural parameters. Then the question that LaRouche is asking, well, how do we scientifically understand economics to the point where we can maximize the ability of an individual to act on that society, to develop that society, to develop the culture which is developing them. Right? So you have this interplay of dynamics. My friend and I were talking about Leibniz before. Leibniz founded the science of dynamics. Right? Going back to his Specimen Dynamicum and really pulling from a lot of what Plato's going through. And Timaeus with his notion of culture. So we brought up this notion of classical tragedy to this congressman, and this is when he freaked out. He said, well, what do you expect me to do? What do you expect me to do, right? We're saying, no, look, man, the culture is acting on you and making you totally impotent. And so our role as youth, right, we're not congressmen. We're not in the Congress, we're not in the parliament. What we can do is organize the base. Get people riled up such that they show their face politically where normally they wouldn't. They feel remoralized because they know that the youth of this country and others are actually taking a stand and being politically proactive. Because they know fundamentally that they are playing a role. Seeing that we're living, we're breathing in a culture, right? We fundamentally play a role. When we're dead, we don't. That we know concretely. Heaven, hell, etc. I mean, that's a different idea of immortality than the one I'm going to be touching on today. The one I'm going to be touching on today is defined by solely and nothing else what you do between the bookends of your birth and death. So when people get the sense that you're acting from the standpoint of using your time from birth and death to affect that which comes after you, you can't really do much for what came before. When people get the sense that you as a young person are acting from that standpoint, that you're looking at your life in the now from after you're dead, the standpoint of after you're dead, and asking yourself constantly the question, well, am I maximizing my ability to be effective, to help and change the most people's lives after I'm dead now?
Most people say no.
Right. Well, most people don't ask that question until their deathbed. And then it's more in the form of, oh, shit. God damn it. Why did I waste all that time making millions of dollars so my son could have a trust fund and develop a cocaine habit? Right? Get a house on Nantucket or something. But that fundamentally, I mean, that's the starting point of Mr. LaRouche's economics. You got to remember, LaRouche is from the Franklin Roosevelt generation. He's not from Franklin Roosevelt's generation. He's from the generation who were adolescents fighting in World War II when Franklin Roosevelt was president. So his notion of a society is from the standpoint of we have an individual who is honest, who's communicating with us, the people, who's integrating us into the discussion and the dialogue process. Franklin Roosevelt was famous for his fireside chats. First one, I suggest everybody listen to it. You can get it online for free, I believe. The first one, he's giving a briefing on the banking system. He's saying, this is what a banking system should do. This is what ours is doing. Tomorrow, I'm going to shut down all the banks and make sure that they start doing what they should be doing. Now, he's going to the people for that, right? He's trying to get support from the people for that. He's not in backdoor meetings with Wall Street bankers saying, no, I swear, I'll save you as much money as possible, man, don't worry. You know, some growling guy saying, oh, you better. I paid for your campaign. Right? That's how politics is envisioned today, people think about it today. But you had an organizer. Franklin Roosevelt was an organizer. He was organizing the base of the population. He's going to the base of the population, saying, you want to fundamentally change the social structure? I know how to do it. Help me out. Vote for me, right? And it's this kind of thing. You know, Lincoln, for example, he developed a reputation for this, a reputation. People knew him as an honest fighter. And so when the time came that the United States desperately needed somebody to make an intervention, to both save the Union and abolish slavery, create an economic system that would be productive, they went to Lincoln. And Lincoln essentially said, fine, I guess I'll run for president. You know, Plato brings this up in The Republic, right? He says, an individual cultivates their sense of immortality and then is called upon by their society to rule. Because of the work that they've been doing, qualifying themselves to do it in a way that nobody else could. Right? It's not like the popularity contest you see today for the U.S. presidency. You know, you just fucking might as well be prom king and queen. You got, you know, your prom king and Barack, and your prom queen and Hillary, and they're duking it out for who's going to get the last dance to the White House. So, in a sense, that's it. The policy discussion isn't there. Reality, the notion that, you know, we could actually intervene on some of these problems. For example, both Hillary and Barack are in the Senate. You want to prove to the American people you're courageous, you're worthy of leadership? Go to work. Show up in the Senate. Stand up on the floor and say the atrocity in Iraq cannot wait till 2009, when hopefully I'll be president. I'm going to do something now. I'm not going to wait to be qualified as president as such after taking billions and billions of dollars from hedge funds and kindred forms of sodomy, legalized sodomy. I'm going to take legalized money from whorehouses and gambling institutions, and then I'll do something potent after I've been totally bought out.
That's why I've seen Ron Paul. If you've seen Ron Paul lately giving a completely different viewpoint on these things and actually saying something from the party that you never expect.
Yeah. Well, also, Chuck Hagel. I mean, I think Ron Paul is a little lost in this question of economics. But as far as outspokenness, ability to be outspoken, is a real, like, American sense in it, in a good connotation. He's not, he's got a kind of a cult following because this whole gold standard thing. The Randians love him. He's an Ayn Rand freak. So as far as economics is concerned, he needs a lot of work because it's the opposite. His idea of economics is the opposite of Roosevelt's. He's saying you need less, more, less governmental intervention versus a Rooseveltian idea, which is saying that you can create a tax structure, tariffs, regulations, etc., where you encourage the development of certain materials, raw materials, steel, trains, technologies, manufacturing, even education. You give people scholarships to be engineers, etc. You within your government from the top actually create the right potential in the right places to develop the right portions of your economy and society.
I don't know if you've ever looked at the Canadian side of money making, you know, but you know, I know it's like this in the U.S. as well in terms of economics. And if that's what we're going to talk about, is you know, I mean, what we're seeing is right now, I mean, that banks are creating all the money, whereas, you know, here in Canada we have a different situation as how that is all done, and that's done through the Bank of Canada. And whereas, you know, in 1974, right when Trudeau left, what it was is that it was 50% of the money was made by the Bank of Canada at 0% interest.
Oh yeah.
Therefore, creating money within the system that was interest free, and that in itself, you know, I mean, what you see in the U.S. and what you see here, and is that the eventually they will not be able to keep up with the interest rates, and eventually you'll have another depression. I think it's a totally different viewpoint that needs to be taken, at least in Canada. I know in the U.S. it's a different thing. But in Canada, there is an easy solution, and that's by requiring banks to have new money within their account, within their holdings, where they re-land the same amount over and over and over again, having 0% money. So therefore, the interest becomes, no one is paying, there's no new money to pay the interest, which will, you know, therefore have to keep raising interest. Eventually, we're to the point where you can't keep up, and you'll have another depression. It's a viewpoint within Canada that ought to be at least mentioned here.
Yeah, it's funny though, because the U.S. Constitution, under it, the current Federal Reserve System, as it's been operating for 100 years, is unconstitutional.
That's right, since 1913, is it not?
Yeah. Because what it is it's a, as you probably know, it's a concert of individuals, private bankers. Whereas what the Constitution specifies is that credit is created from the Congress.
Government.
Yeah. And Hamilton's report on public credit, where he explains why he put this in the Constitution, is in a sense, if you look at the American Constitution, it's a template for how you guys are going to set up your own. You have Hamilton's conspiracy in two very specific places. It's evident only in his writings up until that point, pretty much. Him and Franklin. First, and he explains this further in his report on the manufacturers and then on public credit. The first one is the idea of the general welfare being the object in the preamble under which every action of the government is vectored towards protecting. General welfare, common defense, ensuring the liberty and posterity. Liberty and any Canadian want to help out? I'm going to read it because it's just the most scientific sentence in the world. This is the preamble to the American Constitution. And this is the purpose of the Constitution. This isn't like one of the rules or one of the provisions or one of the sections. This is the umbrella principle. This is what the